gun, clattering over rooftops after the old man, stepping so briskly to meet only death who waited, old Foss knew, so patient and still below the unceasing heaving of the water. Once before, the old man had gone to sea in a sieve with his jumbly girl, and her eyes of jade to match her skin, and her smiles like sweet heartache in blue. Her touch against his cheek was a heart stopped, her voice in his ear a thought to fill immensity. They went indeed to visit with the 60 contending winds, who traded them wine for their baubles brought out of the world, giving a man a sweet drink called ringbury for little rings from the noses of pigs, or unfinished paintings thrown discarded into the sea, or perhaps for the occasional runcible spoon. They sailed into the shifting thickness beyond the edge of things, and were drawn into the sky by fiery birds and dreamed beside the islands of the sun and the night river. And who knew? Sieves sink more slowly than one might suppose. At least sometimes, when the wind is right to hold them up, perhaps, or perhaps when one moves too fast to notice one is sinking. Old Foss had come after him, hiding in the rigging or under the bundles to trade, watching and waiting. And one day, when the water of night came in too high, and no one was left to bail it out, and it was too late by far, old Foss whispered in the old man's ear as he dreamed, "Time to come home, for the water's rising. Time to wake up, now or never. Time to dream a little less, and live a little more, old friend." And a partial payment on a debt never to be repaid was made.
"Thank you," the old man said, when awake and in his bed again, "for surely I would have drowned."
And yet something was taken from the old man, too, something taken that can never be returned, what the jumbly girl meant to him, and for that there was a new debt, never to be repaid.
"Why did you bother me?"
the old man would say at other times, when the confusion came to him.
"Why didn't you leave me to drown in peace, in bliss for other things, with my jumbly girl?"
For they had tried to keep him.
"Stay,"
they had told him, despite the rising water, the leaking of the sieve.
"Stay and dream with us."
"Come with me," he had said to his jumbly girl. "Come with me and be my love. We will think of things to do to pass the time, though it will not be this. We will paint unfinished pictures by the shore and hold hands inside the rain. I will write you poems, and you will tell bad jokes. It's not this, but isn't it something?"
And she agreed to come with him, to meet him in the morning by the shore of everything, below the sun, beside the night, where the skybirds came to draw them home by silver cords in their fiery beaks, on a raft made of fronds from the twangum tree. He and old Foss waited for her to come from the sieve as it sank in the river of night, but she did not appear. Somehow, it seemed, in stepping from the sieve to the shore to the raft, he had misplaced her. When he had turned back to hold out his hand and help her out, she was gone. She never reappeared, and the jumblies disappeared from the sieve with the morning light, like fog retreating into the sea. But with an ache like when you remember what you thought the world was going to be like when you were young and foolish.
"Come on, old man," old Foss had said. "The sieve is sinking fast. Will I ever see her again?"
There is no answer to such questions, and he offered none. But the old man asked it again, asked it so many times over the years, that old Foss finally said,
"I'm sorry, old man." "Oh, I know it's all right, old Foss."
But it wasn't. Old Foss leaped from roof to roof like a young cat with nothing to lose, not a fat old cat with everything at stake. The rain had depressed him, then frustrated him, then made him ironic and bitterly elated. He sang, "How many lives, how many lives, how many more lives for the cat? At least one more, at least one more, and another one after that," as he leaped across an alleyway and scrabbled onto the roof on the other side. When he reached the edge of town, he climbed quickly, noisily, awkwardly down a drainpipe full with leaking water rushing. Leaping off the pipe, he landed badly. Quickly, looking around, licking his shoulder uselessly in the rain, and walking with what dignity he could muster toward the shore, His orange and black fur matted to his bulging body where it wasn't sticking out ridiculously. Then he saw the old man curled into a ball on the hill, halfway down to the beach, a white blur among the gray of water falling. Old Foss ran to him. Old Foss whispered in his ear,
"Come, old man. Time to come in. The water is falling fast, and your nightshirt is thin."
"She came to me in my dreams,"
the old man shouted suddenly, his eyes opening wide and wild.
"She came to me in my dreams. They've come again in the sieve to take me to sea."
"This would be the last time," old Foss said. "Wait a little while longer, and we will find ways to pass the time. Painting unfinished pictures by the shore. Or you can pet me by the fire when it rains, or..."
He didn't know what to say. Could he do this to the old man again? Take him from his jumbly girl? For the Jumblies were by the shore, and the jumbly girl was with them. As the rain lessened, they came into sight. She was leaving them and wandering up the hill, a ghost in green, her voice on the wind.
"Come with us, come to stay, and we will sail under the sea, and we will never leave, but we will never want to."
Old Foss turned away from looking at her.
"I suppose you should go," Old Foss thought.
"I suppose you could go, and I should stay, for I only wanted you for myself, an old debt I will never be able to repay." He didn't say it because it hurt too much to say it. But the old man did not turn his head to look at his jumbly girl. She came closer, calling again,
"Come, come, come to sea, to the sieve that sinks below the waves until we drown, to the lost worlds below the sun."
But the old man did not turn his head. The jumbly girl stopped.
"Can't you hear me, love?"
Old Foss dared not turn to look at her again. The old man did not hear. He could not see. Old Foss would not give away her presence. The jumbly girl stood, her body heaving, crying, Old Foss supposed, but the rain made that indeterminate. That, at least, was what he tried to tell himself. The old man cried too, and that he could see despite the rain, for the old man beat his breast and tore at his thinning hair and pulled hard on his frumpy old beard until he pulled the hair out in uneven patches.
"I want to die," the old man said,
as the jumbly girl reached out for him with arms of green embrace, with love forever and ever for him, to death. Yes, certainly to death, but perhaps beyond as well.
"I'm sorry I made a mistake so long ago," Old Foss said. "That time by the River of Night, I should have let you drown. Or maybe you have with me."
But the old man didn't hear, or couldn't listen. Old Foss mewed piteously, wet through.
"Oh, Old Foss," the old man said, "look at you. Oh, you're wet through."
Old Foss shivered and looked to him, like he had looked to him once long ago as a kitten lost in the rain.
"Come on, Old Foss, let's go home,"
the old man said, rising, pulling Old Foss against him, heading back up the hill.
"They're not coming after all,"
he choked on the words.
"They're not here."
The old man leaned over Old Foss, and Old Foss peered over the old man's shoulder to see the jumblies come in a heap to the jumbly girl crying on the hill. They covered her in their love, with their arms at all angles and their boots kicking out, and their eyes green compassion. They smiled a blue benediction.
"I'm sorry,"
they said to the jumbly girl. In turning, they all walked, or rolled, or shambled downhill.
"I'm sorry,"
they said together, and held her in their arms until they vanished in rain.
"Home again soon,"
the old man said, soothing, but tired, like a drunk man sobered by sorrow on his way home again from a lost night on the town, or like a storm-tossed sailor thrown on the shore, wobbling inland to safety.
"It's all right. It's all right. It's all right, Old Foss."
"I'm sorry," Old Foss said.
"There, there,"
the old man said, though he couldn't hear.
"It's all right. It's all right."
But it wasn't.
A Safe Place to Be, Carol M. Schwiller. Carol Emshwiler grew up in both Michigan and France, and currently divides her time between New York and California. She is the winner of 2 Nebula Awards for her stories Creature and I Live With You. She has also won the World Fantasy Award for Life Achievement. She's been the recipient of a National Endowment for the Arts grant and 2 New York State grants. Her short fiction has been published in many literary and science fiction magazines, and her most recent books are the novels Mr. Boots and The Secret City, and the collection I Live With You and You Don't Know It. A new collection is forthcoming from PS Publishing. Emshwiler says, I had no special cat in mind. I haven't had a cat for a long time, but I like to use animals in my stories in all sorts of ways. We used to have a marmalade cat like this one. Before he was altered, he used to get in a fight every night, came back with torn ears all the time. He went off to college with my daughter, where he lived with a batch of students who had a pet rabbit. Then he came back, got fat, and lived a long, lazy life.
It started with a funny feeling in the bottoms of my feet. Something is going to happen, perhaps an earthquake. That's what it feels like. But perhaps terrorists on the way. Whatever it is, something's coming. Why did I, of all people, an old lady, get this warning while everybody else is going on as usual? Have I a special talent nobody else has? But the cat feels it too. He's been shaking his paws as if they feel exactly like my feet do. He looks at me as if to say, why don't you do something? I tell him I will. It's coming closer. I'm getting out of here before everybody tries to leave at the same time. Though, could it be that I'm just feeling the future in general? Disaster will come to all of us, and at my age, it can't be that far away. I'll be as dead as most all of humanity already is. Mother, Dad, Dostoevsky. But can I take a chance that this tingly feeling is just because of the normal run of things? If only I knew when. And also, who to tell? I'd like company through all this. Not that a good cat isn't company enough, and I do talk things over with him. But a person would be nice, too. I can't think of anybody to tell who would believe me or wouldn't just get in my way as I try to leave in search of safety. That tingly, rattly vibration is getting worse, rising from the ground up through my feet and rattling my spine. This morning, I could even feel it from my 5th-floor apartment. I ran for the central hallway. I stood there for 20 minutes. Then I grabbed Natty, put his harness and leash on him, and ran outside and down the block and huddled under a tree. Again, I waited. The cat was shaking as much as I was. A sure sign that I'm right. I ran farther, but had to stop to catch my breath in a doorway near the park. Here, in a place where pigeons are always wobbling along, there wasn't a single one. Not one. That scared both of us even more. I must have looked just how I felt, because somebody asked me what was wrong. I said, just a dizzy spell is all. I didn't want anybody else to know. I wanted to get out and safely away before any of the others found out something was going to happen. I checked the feelings in my feet again. I feel a rumbling, for sure. By now so strong, I wonder why everybody doesn't feel it. Well, all the better, then. It gives me plenty of time to escape. A mountaintop would be a good place. Nothing would fall down on me from up there, and water wouldn't reach. But there aren't even any hills around here. I'll head west, though I don't know if there's time. But out in the country will be better than the city. I'll bring my money and my raincoat. I go home, eat a big last meal, pack a knapsack with cat food, it'll do for both of us, my vitamins, and go. I bring Natty in the top part of the knapsack. He doesn't mind. He's glad I'm finally doing something. I ask a taxi driver to take me $20 worth towards the west. He's nice. He takes me even farther. He doesn't care that I sneaked a cat into his cab. I ask him to come with us. We'd like the company. Especially such a nice man and with a cab to ride in. I tell him why I was getting away. I say we should hurry before the roads get too crowded with people trying to escape. He doesn't say so, but I don't think he believes me. He prefers getting back to work. So I start walking. He drove me a good ways into the suburbs. I never expected to get this far in just one day. Even though I'm still scared, this is all turning out fine. I stand still and check the bottoms of my feet again. And yes, no doubt about it, danger. Though I keep reminding myself that life is just temporary anyway, and at my age even more so. But right now, I have to find some place to spend the night. I don't want to use up any more of my money than I have to. It has to last at least to the Rockies. I keep walking well into the night. I was hoping to get beyond the little houses and warehouses to farmland, but no such luck. I wanted to sleep in some country place, a forest, or a park. Finally, I'm too worn out to go on. I drop where I stop. There isn't a bush or a tree in sight, just warehouses and airplanes keep coming over low. I'm so tired they don't bother me except for waking me up early in the morning. I worried the cat would get scared and run away. But he stayed with me. I keep his leash on most of the time, but I don't attach it to anything. He's too old to run off. So off we go again, after sharing a cat food breakfast. How come nobody else is trying to escape? Most people are heading into the city as if everything was just as usual. Is this a special talent of mine worthy of study, just as animals predict earthquakes? Should I tell a scientist about it before whatever it is happens, so that when it does happen, I'll have predicted it? How does one find a scientist? And it has to be somebody interested in this sort of study. I would be surprised if I pass a lot of universities along the way. If the danger is as close as it feels, I'll have to hurry and find somebody. I'm so happy with our progress. I take us to a diner for lunch, fish for Natty, and a hamburger for me. That night I find a good place, 9 feet high, 4 feet long, 3 feet wide. What passes for a window? I won't say where, though it mustn't be thought that I'm ashamed of it. Actually, I don't think I'm ever ashamed of anything of that nature, not even that I'm getting rather dirty and must. By now, I'm far enough not to have to worry about a tsunami. But this is tornado country now. Natty and I keep studying the sky. Wherever I end up, I would like a small tree. That is, if I can't have a large one. Living in the city, I haven't had a tree of my own of any sort since I came here long ago. Also, I'd like a nice round lichen-covered rock that heats up during the day and stays hot all evening. I'd like a place to build a fire and a log beside it to sit on. I'd like a nice bed for Natty. I buy myself a shopping cart to carry stuff like water bottles. I'm getting ready for crossing places in Middle America where the rest stops are far between. I ask for rides in the parking lots, but if I don't get one, I just start walking. And I usually don't get one. I don't blame the people. After all, I'm dirty and raggedy, and my bundles and the shopping cart are bulky and don't fit in anything but trucks. If I saw me humping along with all this junk, I'd take me for a crazy person. I wouldn't pick me up either. Even so, now and then I do get a ride, usually in an old pickup that isn't going far. I forget how many days it's been, but up to now everything is serene with the world. Of course, I'm not getting the news. Maybe a disaster has already happened and I don't know about it, though I'd think people in diners and rest stops would be talking about it. I always read the headlines in the newspapers when I pass by them. I don't waste money on them. And you'd think if the disaster had happened that my feet would stop sending me all these signals. Natty's, too. Though maybe after one disaster there might be another right behind it. Ahead, you can see the road winding up a hill. I dread trying to climb it pushing my cart. But before I get to it, there's a town, and I pass one of those little country hospitals. It's right here, handy. I'm going in and have them check my feet. It might be important for them to study me, for omens. Maybe Natty's, too. I hide my cart behind the bushes near the door. The lady at the desk asks me if I want a shower first. I did suspect I was pretty smelly by now, but I tell her I'll just get dirty again. I'm on the road, I say. But wouldn't you like to take this opportunity? I haven't washed since I started on this journey. Just a little bit in the bathrooms at the rest stops. I know she means the doctor I'm going to see would like it a lot better if I did. But what about my cat? She lets him come into the bathroom with me, since, she says, he's on a leash. Then they let him into the doctor's office with me, too. Everybody is very nice here. I want to report my feet, and my cat's feet. He doesn't believe me about my feet predicting disaster. He doesn't say so, but I can tell.
Well, he says, there's plenty of disasters around to predict.
That type of little black mustache he has always intimidates me, but he's quite nice underneath it. This is something really, really big, like a tornado, or an earthquake, or a gigantic mudslide, mud as far as the eye can see.
Where are you living? Are you eating?
Oh, yes, and fish, lots of fish. I know it's good for you. I don't want him to think I'm just an ignorant tramp.
There's a shelter just down the road if you need help. You can get a free meal there.
Will they have cat food?
Do you have a place to live?
But, doctor, these tingly feelings, it's getting worse. I thought maybe it was important. I thought you'd like to look into it.
Nothing to worry about. Old people get these odd nerve twinges all the time. Let me give you the address of this place where they'll help you.
I'm worried they might put me away. I'd have to stay here, and the disaster might be right in this area, and I couldn't escape. I say I'll go there right away, but I won't.
I'll drive you if you can wait a bit.
I don't mind walking. I have to show him all my money before he finally lets me go. I still have quite a bit. Also, I show him my vitamins and my cod liver oil. Both Natty and I take it. That impresses him. At least he doesn't charge me much. But he didn't do anything either except to tell me I'm fine. It's going to be too bad. I mean, the big disaster. There are so many nice people in the world like these people at the hospital. It's a shame so many of them will have to die. I'm trying to tell them, but they won't listen. I don't go for the free meal, though that would have been nice. I haven't had any vegetables for a long time. but I'm worried they'll stop me. I know it looks bad, an old lady with a big bundle walking across the country. I'll have to try to think of a good reason for doing it. Maybe for some cause or other, like breast cancer. Why didn't I think of that before? By evening, I finally come to the hill. The road climbs back and forth. It's still a wide and sweeping four lanes. This is going to be hard. Dangerous, too. A good place for a landslide. I struggle on. Not a single good place to rest. Everything on a slant. A silvery, sporty car stops next to me, the top down. It's the doctor. Just the sort of car to go with his mustache. What's he doing way out here? He says he doesn't like how I look. It's twilight. How come he can see me so well? He's popped the trunk. Put your cart in the back. I step off the road on the rocky downside. He can't follow, not in the car. But he's out and is opening the passenger door for me. I'll drive you. Thank goodness it's almost dark, and it's even darker in the shadows of the boulders where Natty and I hide. Natty's a talkative cat, but he knows not to make a sound. The doctor calls a few more times. I can help. Exactly what I don't want most is help. Finally, he drives off. What now? Are they going to be chasing me? Capture the crazy woman? Do I have something else to worry about? Why do I care? I'm going to walk on through the night. It's safer. Whenever a car goes by, I hide in the ditch. It's not easy, what with my cart and all. At least you can see the cars coming from a long ways off. We reach the top of the hill. Now the road will be flat again for a nice long while. Finally, there in the ditch, I just have to stay and sleep. In the morning, I see there's somebody else walking along, way, way, way ahead of me, by about 6 miles, I'd say. Here, the road is so straight and flat, and there's so few trees you can see for miles. I think the next hillock is probably about 12 miles away. Hours pass, but I'm catching up. He doesn't stop to rest. I don't either. What if he, too, has funny feelings? And there'll be safety in numbers. For me, at least. Maybe if the doctor sees I have somebody, especially a man, he won't bother me anymore. I get all shaky with hope. Somebody else, maybe, who knows what I and Natty know. He won't think I'm crazy. Finally, he sits down. It takes me half an hour to catch up, and then I walk past so as to take a good look first. We're both elderly. We're both skinny from so much walking. We're both browned by the sun and have chapped lips. We both have big hats. I got mine when I started wondering about crossing the desert. He stares as I go by. He's wondering about me as much as I'm wondering about him. He has a cart much bigger and sturdier than mine. More like a wheelbarrow, only he's rigged it with a loop around his waist so he can pull it. I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't have a tent. And there's a frying pan tied on top. I'll bet he never hitchhikes. He's got too much stuff. He's found a nice spot to rest. There's an arroyo and actually a few spindly cottonwoods growing along the banks. Not exactly giving shade. Under the road is a culvert, for when there's water in the arroyo, that'll be where he pees. I turn around and come back. He looks like a country person, farmer or some such, though by now I may not look like I'm from the city either. Before I sit down, not too close, I searched the sky. Out here you can see a lot of it. I say, so far everything is fine. He doesn't bother answering. It's clear that it is. We sit silently, but I can't tell if it's a comfortable silence or an uncomfortable one. Natty's the only one who gives a questioning.
Meow.
When the man gets up to go on, I do too. He didn't ask me to come, but he didn't say not to. It's evening, and this was a good spot to spend the night, but off he goes. He may be trying to get away from us. Some people don't like cats. Is he going to walk all night? I don't dare ask. If I ask, he may tell me not to follow. We go on and on. Towards morning, he comes to a group of spindly trees. I stay about 20 yards behind so as not to be a bother. I collapse just off the road, in the ditch, so to speak. At least there's enough runoff for there to be bushes all along the roadside. Almost like the edges of the rivers. I don't even have the energy to get us our can of cat food. I wake up late the next morning to the sound of traffic, if you can call one car about every 10 minutes traffic. My feet are tingling even more than before. Whatever it is coming closer. I study the sky. Not a cloud in sight. Not a tree either, except for the clump where the man camped. He's gone on ahead. He's already a few miles down the road. Maybe he does mind us following, but I'm not going to let him get away. I and Natty eat our cat food and hurry after him. We're faster than he is, what with the big bundle he has to pull. It's such a nice morning. All along the roadside, the rabbit brush is in bloom, a bright yellow. I hum in spite of whatever disasters might be on the way. You don't have to mope around just because your feet tingle and the world is full of depressing things and something really, really big and horrible is about to happen. Pretty soon, we're almost up to where I want to walk, just a few yards behind the man. So far, he hasn't said a single word. But here's the doctor's silvery car again. I'm not expecting him. I don't have time to even think of hiding. The old man stops, turns around, and watches. It really does look as if we're together, and as if the old man's waiting for me. I run up and grab the old man's arm. Before the doctor leans out the window and says anything, I say, "I'm walking for breast cancer. I forgot to tell you." "But I can help. I can help you both." He's walking for breast cancer, too. The two of us and our bundles and Natty wouldn't fit in the doctor's little car anyway. We don't want to get helped. One nice thing. The old man is letting me hang onto his bony elbow. I wasn't sure he would, seeing as how he's always walking off without me and without a word. And then he does talk. "She's with me." His voice croaks out as if he never uses it. And I guess he never does. "Why don't you people go to our shelter, get yourself cleaned up, get a rest? How old are you anyway? I don't want you having a heart attack out here." The man says, "Young enough to walk all day." The doctor grabs my other arm, the one holding my cart. Natty is sitting on top of it in his usual spot. He lashes out and the doctor gets 4 good scratches all along his hand. I let go of my cart. I can't help it. And it bounces down into the ditch and tips over. I run down to see if Natty is hurt, and so does the old man. The doctor doesn't. He's looking at his scratches. What kind of a doctor is that? But Natty isn't there. I lift up my cart to see if he's squashed underneath it. Then I see him galloping down the road, his leash dragging. If there was a tree anywhere near, he'd be up in it. I should have known. Cats are fast. They hardly ever get hurt. I leave my cart in the ditch and run down the road after him. Next thing, here's the doctor's car right beside me.
Get in. I'll help you catch it.
It, he says. I run into the ditch again and then beyond into the brush. The doctor gives up and drives off. The old man is waiting back for me beside my cart.
Cats come back, he says.
Nice of him to say so, but we're not anywhere for a cat to come back to. How will Natty get along without me? And out here in the middle of nowhere? This changes everything.
What we'll do,
the old man says, speaking slowly and calmly and in that raspy voice of his.
We'll go on a little bit farther and stop where we think he might have run to. And then we'll stay put until we find him.
He gives me an apple. I haven't had one in a long time, but I can't swallow. I take one bite and give the apple back. I know it's valuable. That man has all sorts of things I didn't know he had. He gets out a little camping stove and makes me tea. I do feel better after that. At least I have more energy to go looking for Natty. We go down the road a bit farther, calling out. Nothing here but desert. There won't be anything for Natty to drink, and I worry about that leash dragging behind him. And what about hawks? Every now and then I step off the road and look around. I look into the shadows. By now, Natty's a desert cat and knows that it's cooler under things in the shade. If there's a disaster, I want to face it with Natty. And if I escape it, I don't want to escape without Natty. Maybe this is the disaster. At least it's my disaster. When we settle down for the night, I sleep a bit away from the old man in case Natty is afraid of him. I open a can of cat food and leave it near me. I can't eat my share of it. I feel too bad. I also leave a cup of water. I wonder what sort of creature I'll attract that I don't want. Do rattlesnakes like cat food? Maybe Natty is dead already. There's always coyotes. The man and I set up a kind of camp, just our bundles and his stove and pan, and branch out from there. It's several yards off the road and behind an old tumble-down wall, probably the remains of an old stagecoach change of horses stop. He hasn't set up his tent. No need. It never rains out here. He not only has apples, but carrots, too. Kind of dried out, but still good. But I can't eat. We wander around calling, "Kitty, kitty, kitty." We look under every bush. I hope Natty's good at catching lizards. There are a lot of them. Except he's got that leash holding him back. The doctor drives back and forth twice a day. He must live in the next town from the hospital. He stops now and then and calls out to us that he just wants to help. Once he yells out that at least we're hidden behind that old wall. What does he mean by that? If he really wanted to help, he could bring us some bottles of water. We won't be able to stay here much longer. But the old man says he'll trot back to that town. And he does mean trot, to bring back some water. He'll use my cart because it's lighter, and then we can stay here longer. After he leaves, I spend the morning in the usual way, calling and looking in the shadows for a dead or dying cat. And then, that afternoon, it rains, a hard rain. First, I think it's the disaster, but it isn't. I rush out in it calling, "Kitty, kitty, kitty!" I'm sopping, but I don't care. Only later do I remember to put out cups and the old man's frying pan to collect water. Then it stops raining, and then suddenly flowers. As far as the eye can see, not mud, but flowers. I walk out in it. It smells wonderful. And here's a whole mass of little luminous blue butterflies. I never knew such a thing could be. Have I been wrong about the disaster all this time? Is it to be something beautiful instead of something bad? A disaster of flowers? But then I feel a sharp twinge in my feet as if to remind me I'm wrong, and there's a big disaster out there just waiting to come down on us all. I search the sky again, except now I don't care. I yell, "Come on, tsunami! Come flood and fire, tornado and meteorites!" Nothing happens. Then I hear the old man coming back. He's whistling. You just can't help it. What with all this beauty? He sees me and waves, calls out, "I have tomatoes and peaches." It's as if he knew they were things I haven't had since I started on the journey to escape. But I sit down in the middle of the flowers and start to cry. So many good things, and I don't even care. He sees I won't be able to eat for a while. He puts everything behind our wall and then comes out into the flowers and butterflies, carefully trying to avoid stepping on flowers, and sits beside me. After a bit, I take a good look at him, a better look than before. He sits hugging one knee. He's wearing shorts. His legs are hairy, stringy and knobby, but strong-looking. His big hat partly hides his face, but I already know he's an ugly man and needs a shave. His teeth stick out, and his chin recedes. His nose has a bump in the middle, but all of a sudden, he looks beautiful. Like Natty. Natty's not a handsome cat, but I've never seen one I like better. I say, "Thank you." He nods, a series of nods as if, "Yes, yes, yes," and then shakes his head the other way as if, "It's not important." I wonder what his name is. I think to reach out and touch his knee, to say something nice. But here comes the doctor. His silver car is parked right across from our wall. He walks toward us, trampling on flowers, scattering butterflies. He has a bandage on his hand where Natty scratched him.
"I thought you'd be gone by now, or at least gone for help."
Oh, my God. He has Natty's red leather leash. He's slapping it against his thigh, then he hands it to me.
"Here's your leash."
We've been looking and calling ourselves hoarse, and he's had Natty all this time. Or at least he knows where he is. I can just see it, the doctor driving down the road and seeing that red leash and tricking Natty some way. Or more likely, the leash hooked on a prickly black bush. I grab it and start whipping him with it.
He's not ready. He falls backwards into flowers, and I keep on lashing at him.
Long as I'm winning, the old man stands there watching, but when the doctor gets up and hits me one good slap and knocks me over, the old man grabs him from behind and holds him. He's shorter than the doctor, but you can see in his stringy arms, very strong. I'm thinking, my old man. The doctor says, it's again, at the pound back in Wilkerville. Unless it's dead, they don't keep them very long. I don't even grab a water bottle. I start running back down the road. The doctor yells, "Don't be dumb!" We're maybe only 7 or 8 miles from town, and days of walking and pushing my cart have made me strong, too. I run on and on. Pretty soon the doctor's car pulls up beside me. Since the top is down, as usual, I see right away the old man is in the car with him. The old man tells me to get in. If he's there, I guess it's all right. Though maybe the doctor will see that we both end up stuck in what might as well be the pound for people. The car's only a 2-seater. I have to sit on the old man's lap, his arms around me. It's a nice place to be. But then, a huge dark cloud comes towards us right down the road, like a huge, huge dust devil. And it's full of flowers. And the sound. Here comes the disaster. Finally, I'm actually glad that something's happening at last. I don't have Natty to hug, but I do have the old man's arms around me, nice and tight. The doctor stops the car and starts putting the top up, but at the last minute, the disaster veers away, rises, then dissipates in a rain of flowers. Flowers all over us, wet and fragrant. We're all out of breath, though we haven't done anything but just sit here. We look at each other, even the doctor. I look into the old man's black eyes and turn away fast. I'm thinking, that's where all his calmness comes from, down in there somewhere. Again, I wonder what his name is. The doctor drives us much too fast, even for the desert, into town. At the pound, they say, "That skinny old marmalade cat, he was an odd one." "Well, where is he?" "He got out, just today. We don't know how he did it." I always knew he was smarter than most, but now I wish he wasn't. I sit down on the curb. The old man says, "Smart cat." Then he'll come back. His slow, raspy voice. They always do. It's a reassuring voice, and nice to hear it, but it doesn't reassure me. The old man sees that. "He will," the doctor says. "It's a cat, for heaven's sake. You'll be fine without it." How dare he? Of course I won't be fine. I stand up and attack him again. I land 2 good blows before anybody can do anything. But he slaps me down. "The town wants you in the shelter. You're a nuisance and an eyesore. Look at yourselves." The old man pushes him away and gets punched and falls backwards. That makes me so mad I get up and fight even harder. It doesn't do any good. I'm on the ground again beside my man. But there's a great yowling and howling, and here, off the roof of the pound, comes an orange ball of claws down on the doctor's head, and a terrible racket. I've heard cats can do that, but I never actually heard the sound before. The doctor tries to run away, but you can't run away from a cat on your head. He's around the block and out of sight, but we can still hear Natty. We look at each other again, and this time I let myself look way down in there. He nods, and then I nod. He takes my hand. How strong and calloused both our hands are, like pieces of sandpaper. We sit down and wait for Natty to come back. "You know there is no safe place," he says. And I say, "I know it." "And not all disasters are that bad." And I say, "I know it." Pretty soon, Natty comes swaggering back. We walk to our things, me with Natty on my shoulder. Let's go on. Till we get to a nice green place with a river. And trees. And a hill to be on top of. And a cottage. I wonder what his name is.
Nine Lives to Live. Sharon McCrum.
Sharon McCrum is an award-winning Southern writer, best known for her Appalachian ballad novels set in the North Carolina-Tennessee mountains, including the New York Times bestsellers She Walks These Hills and The Rosewood Casket. Her other best-selling novels include The Ballad of Frankie Silver and The Songcatcher. Her most recent novels are The Devil Amongst the Lawyers and Faster Pastor, the latter co-authored with NASCAR driver Adam Edwards. McCrum was named a Virginia Woman of History in 2008 for achievement in literature. Other honors include AWA Outstanding Contribution to Appalachian Literature Award, the Chafin Award for Southern Literature, the Plattner Award for Short Story, and AWA's Best Appalachian Novel. She lives and writes near Roanoke, Virginia. She says, "The inspiration for Nine Lives to Live was an elderly, dignified Maine Coon cat who belonged to a friend of mine. The expression on that cat's face suggested that he disapproved of us, that he outranked us, and that he was not amused. So I started wondering who he used to be. I want to come back as a groundhog. They eat constantly all summer, and when they get fat, they're cute. Then, when the weather turns cold and wet, they crawl into the burrow and go to sleep until it's warm and sunny outside again. And when they wake up, they're thin. People say dolphins are the smartest animals on Earth, but groundhogs have things figured out pretty well, if you ask me."
It had seemed like a good idea at the time. Of course, Philip Danby had only been joking, but he had said it in a serious tone in order to humor those idiot New Age clients who actually seemed to believe in the stuff. "I want to come back as a cat," he'd said, smiling facetiously into the candlelight at the Eskridge dinner table. He had to hold his breath to keep from laughing as the others babbled about reincarnation. The women wanted to come back blonder and thinner, and the men wanted to be everything from Dallas Cowboys to oak trees. Oak trees? And he had to keep a straight face through it all, hoping these dodos would give the firm some business. The things he had to put up with to humor clients. His partner, Giles Eskridge, seemed to have no difficulties in that quarter, however. Giles often said that rich and crazy went together. Therefore, architects who wanted a lucrative business had to be prepared to put up with eccentrics. They also had to put up with long hours, obstinate building contractors, and capricious zoning boards. Perhaps that was why Danby had plumped for life as a cat next time. As he had explained to his dinner companions that night, cats are independent. They don't have to kowtow to anybody. They sleep 16 hours a day, and yet they get fed and sheltered and even loved, just for being their contrary little selves. Sounds like a good deal to me. Julie Eskridge tapped him playfully on the cheek.
"You'd better take care to be a pretty pedigreed kitty, Philip," she laughed, "because life isn't so pleasant for an ugly old alley cat."
"I'll keep that in mind," he told her, "in 50 years or so." It had been more like 50 days. The fact that Giles had wanted to come back as a shark should have tipped him off. When they found out that they'd just built a $3 million building on top of a toxic landfill, the contractor was happy to keep his mouth shut about it for a mere $10,000, and Giles was perfectly prepared to bury the evidence to protect the firm from lawsuits and EPA fines. Looking back on it, Danby realized that he should not have insisted that they report the landfill to the authorities. In particular, he should not have insisted on it at 6 p.m. at the building site, with no one present but himself and Giles. That was literally a fatal error. Before you could say philosophical differences, Giles had picked up a shovel lying near the offending trench, and with one brisk swing, had sent the matter to a higher court. As he pitched headlong into the reeking evidence, Danby's last thought was a flicker of cold anger at the injustice of it all. His next thought was that he was watching a black-and-white movie, while his brain seemed intent upon sorting out a flood of olfactory sensations. Furniture polish, stale coffee, sweaty socks, Prel shampoo, potting soil. He shook his head, trying to clear his thoughts. Where was he? The apparent answer to that was, lying on a gray sofa inside the black-and-white movie, because everywhere he looked he saw the same colorless vista. A concussion, maybe? The memory of Giles Eskridge swinging his shovel came back in a flash. Danby decided to call the police before Giles turned up to try again. He stood up and promptly fell off the sofa. Of course, he landed on his feet. All four of them. Idly, to keep from thinking anything more ominous for the moment, Danby wondered what else the New Age clients had been right about. Was Stonehenge a flying saucer landing pad? Did crystals lower cholesterol? He was in no position to doubt anything just now. He sat twitching his plume of a tail and wishing he hadn't been so flippant about the afterlife at the Eskridge dinner party. He didn't even particularly like cats. He also wished that he could get his paws on Giles in retribution for the shovel incident. First, he would bite Giles's neck, snapping his spine, and then he would let him escape for a few seconds. Then he'd sneak up behind him and pounce. Then bat him into a corner. Danby began to purr in happy contemplation. The sight of a coffee table looming a foot above his head brought the problem into perspective. At present, Danby weighed approximately 15 furry pounds, and he was unsure of his exact whereabouts. Under those circumstances, avenging his murder would be difficult. On the other hand, he didn't have any other pressing business, apart from an 8-hour nap which he felt in need of. First things first, though. Danby wanted to know what he looked like, and then he needed to find out where the kitchen was, and whether sweaty socks and Prel shampoo had left anything edible on the countertops. There would be time enough for philosophical thoughts and revenge plans when he was cleaning his whiskers. The living room was enough to make an architect shudder. Clunky early American sofas and clutter. He was glad he couldn't see the color scheme. There was a mirror above the sofa, though, and he hopped up on the cheap upholstery to take a look at his new self. The face that looked back at him was definitely feline, and so malevolent that Danby wondered how anyone could mistake cats for pets. The yellow, or possibly green, almond eyes glowered at him from a massive triangular face, tiger-striped, and surrounded by a ruff of gray-brown fur. Just visible beneath the ruff was a dark leather collar, equipped with a little brass bell. That would explain the ringing in his ears. The rest of his body seemed massive, even allowing for the fur, and the great plumed tail swayed rhythmically as he watched. He resisted a silly urge to swat at the reflected movement. So, he was a tortoiseshell, or tabby, or whatever they called those brown-striped cats, and his hair was long, and he was still male. He didn't need to check beneath his tail to confirm that. Besides, the reek of ammonia in the vicinity of the sofa suggested that he was not shy about proclaiming his masculinity in various corners of his domain. No doubt it would have interested those New Age clowns to learn that he was not a kitten, but a fully grown cat. Apparently, the arrival had been instantaneous as well. He'd always been given to understand that the afterlife would provide some kind of preliminary orientation before assigning him a new identity. A deity resembling John Denver in rimless glasses and a Sierra Club t-shirt should have been on hand with some paperwork regarding his case, and in a non-threatening conference they would decide what his karma entitled him to become. At least, that's what the New Agers had led him to believe. But it hadn't been like that at all. One minute, he'd been tumbling into a sewage pit, and the next, he had a craving for Meow Mix. Just like that. He wondered what sort of consciousness had been flickering inside that narrow skull prior to his arrival. Probably not much. A brain with the wattage of a lightning bug could control most of the items on the feline agenda. Eat, sleep, snack, doze, dine, nap, and so on. Speaking of eating, he made it to the floor in two moderate bounds, and jingled toward the kitchen, conveniently signposted by the smell of lemon-scented dishwashing soap and stale coffee. The floor could do with a good sweeping, too, he thought, noting with distaste the gritty feel of tracked-in dirt on his velvet paws. The cat dish, tucked in a corner beside the sink cabinet, confirmed his worst fears about the inhabitant's instinct for tackiness. Two plastic bowls were inserted into a plywood cat model, painted white and decorated with a cartoonish cat face. If his food hadn't been at stake, Danby would have sprayed that as an indication of his professional judgment. As it was, he summoned a regal sneer and bent down to inspect the offering. The water wasn't fresh. There were bits of dry cat food floating in it. Did they expect him to drink that? Perhaps he ought to dump it out so that they'd take the hint. And the dry cat food hadn't been stored in an airtight container either. He sniffed contemptuously. The cheap brand, mostly cereal. He supposed he'd have to go out and kill something just to keep his ribs from crashing together. Better check out the counters for other options. It took considerable force to launch his bulk from floor to countertop, and for a moment he teetered on the edge of the sink, fighting to regain his balance, while his bell tolled ominously. But once he righted himself, he strolled onto the counter with an expression of nonchalance, suggesting that his dignity had never been imperiled. He found two breakfast plates stacked in the sink. The top one was a trove of congealing egg yolk and bits of buttered toast. He finished it off, licking off every scrap of egg with his rough tongue, and thinking what a favor he was doing the people by cleaning the plate for them. While he was on the sink, he peeked out the kitchen window to see if he could figure out where he was. The lawn outside was thick and luxurious, and a spreading oak tree grew beside a low stone wall. Well, it wasn't Albuquerque. Probably not California either, considering the healthy appearance of the grass. Maybe he was still in Maryland. It certainly looked like home. Perhaps the transmigration of souls has a limited geographic range, like AM radio stations. After a few moments' consideration, while he washed an offending forepaw, it occurred to Danby to look at the wall phone above the counter. The numbers made sense to him, so apparently he hadn't lost the ability to read. Sure enough, the telephone area code was 301. He wasn't far from where he started. Theoretically, at least, Giles was within reach. He must mull that over, from the vantage point of the windowsill, where the afternoon sun was marvelously warm and soothing. Zzzz. Danby awakened several hours later to a braying female voice calling out,
"Tigger, get down from there this minute. Are you glad Mommy's home, sweetie?"
Danby opened one eye and regarded the woman with an insolent stare. Tigger? Was there no limit to the indignities he must bear? A fresh wave of Prel shampoo told him that the self-proclaimed Mommy was chatelaine of this bourgeois bungalow. And didn't she look the part, too, with her polyester pantsuit and her cascading chins? She set a grocery bag and a stack of letters on the countertop and held out her arms to him.
"And is my snookums ready for din-din?" she cooed.
He favored her with an extravagant yawn, followed by his most forbidding Mongol stare, but his hostility was wasted on the besotted Mrs. He glanced down at the pile of letters. Sherrod. She continued to beam at him as if he had fawned at her feet. As it was, he was so busy studying the address on the Sherrod junk mail that he barely glanced at her. He hadn't left town. His tail twitched triumphantly. Morning Glory Lane was not familiar to him, but he'd be willing to bet that it was a street in Sussex Garden Estates, just off the bypass. That was a couple of miles from Giles Eskridge's mock Tudor monstrosity, but with a little luck and some common sense about traffic, he could walk there in a couple of hours. If he cut through the fields, he might be able to score a mouse or two on the way. Spurred on by the thought of a fresh, tasty dinner that would beg for its life, Danby Tigger trotted to the back door and began to meow piteously, putting his forepaws as far up on the screen door as he could reach.
"Now, Tigger," said Mrs. Sherrod in her most arch tone, "you know perfectly well that there's a litter box in the bathroom. You just want to get outdoors so that you can tomcat around, don't you?"
With that, she began to put away groceries, humming tunelessly to herself. Danby fixed a venomous stare at her retreating figure, and then turned his attention back to the problem at hand, or rather, at Pa. That was just the trouble. Look, Ma, no hands. Still, he thought, there ought to be a way. Because it was warm outside, the outer door was open, leaving only the metal storm door between himself and freedom. Its latch was the straight-handled kind that you pushed down to open the door. Danby considered the factors. Door handle 3 feet above floor, latch opens on downward pressure, 1 15-pound cat intent upon going out. With a vertical bound that Michael Jordan would have envied, Danby catapulted himself upward and caught onto the handle, which obligingly twisted downward as the door swung open at the weight of the feline cannonball. By the time gravity took over and returned him to the ground, he was claw-deep in scratchy, sweet-smelling grass. As he loped off toward the street, he could hear a plaintive voice wailing, "Tigger!" It almost drowned out the jingling of that damned little bell around his neck. 20 minutes later, Danby was sunning himself on a rock in an abandoned field, recovering from the exertion of moving faster than a stroll. In the distance, he could hear the drone of cars from the interstate as the smell of gasoline wafted in on a gentle breeze. As he had trotted through the neighborhood, he'd read street signs, so he had a better idea of his whereabouts now. Windsor Forest, that pretentious little suburb that Giles called home, was only a few miles away, and once he crossed the interstate, he could take a shortcut through the woods. He hoped that La Sherrod wouldn't put out an all-points bulletin for her missing kitty. He didn't want any SPCA interruptions once he reached his destination. He ought to ditch the collar as well, he thought. He couldn't very well pose as a stray with a little bell under his chin. Fortunately, the collar was loose, probably because the ruff around his head made his neck look twice as large. Once he determined that, it took only a few minutes of concentrated effort to work the collar forward with his paws, until it slipped over his ears. After that, a shake of the head, jingle jingle, rid him of Tigger's identity. He wondered how many pets who just disappeared one day had acquired new identities and gone off on more pressing business. He managed to reach the bypass before 5 o'clock, thus avoiding the commuter traffic of rush hour. Since he understood automobiles, it was a relatively simple matter for Danby to cross the highway during a lull between cars. He didn't see what the possums found so difficult about road crossing. Sure enough, there was a ripe gray corpse on the white line, mute testimony to the dangers of indecision on highways. He took a perfunctory sniff, but the roadkill was too far gone to interest anything except the buzzards. Once across the road, Danby stuck to the fields, making sure that he paralleled the road that led to Windsor Forest. His attention was occasionally diverted by a flock of birds overhead, or an enticing rustle in the grass that might have been a field mouse, but he kept going. If he didn't reach the Eskridge house by nightfall, he would have to wait until morning to get himself noticed. In order to get at Giles, Danby reasoned, he would first have to charm Julie Eskridge. He wondered if she was susceptible to needy animals. He couldn't remember whether they had a cat or not. An unspayed female would be nice, he thought. A Siamese, perhaps, with big blue eyes and a sexy voice. Danby reasoned that he wouldn't have too much trouble finding Giles's house. He had been there often enough as a guest. Besides, the firm had designed and built several of the overwrought mansions in the spacious subdivision. Danby had once suggested that they buy Palladian windows by the gross, since every nouveau riche home builder insisted on having a brace of them, no matter what style of house he had commissioned. Giles had not been amused by Danby's observation. He seldom was. What Giles lacked in humor, he also lacked in scruples and moral restraint, but he compensated for these deficiencies with a highly developed instinct for making and holding on to money. While he'd lacked Danby's talent in design and execution, he had a genius for turning up wealthy clients, and for persuading these tasteless yobos to spend a fortune on their showpiece homes. Danby did draw the line at carving up antique Sheraton sideboards to use as bathroom sink cabinets, though. When he also drew the line at environmental crime, Giles had apparently found his conscience an expensive luxury that the firm could not afford. Hence the shallow grave at the new construction site, and Danby's new lease on life. It was really quite unfair of Giles, Danby reflected. They'd been friends since college, and after Danby's parents died, he had drawn up a will, leaving his share of the business to Giles. And how had Giles repaid this friendship? With the blunt end of a shovel. Danby stopped to sharpen his claws on the bark of a handy pine tree. Really, he thought, Giles deserved no mercy whatsoever, which was just as well because, cat-like, Danby possessed none. The sun was low behind the surrounding pines by the time Danby arrived at the Eskridge's mock Tudor home. He had been delayed en route by the scent of another cat, a neutered orange male. Even to his colorblind eyes, an orange cat was recognizable. It might be the shade of gray or the configuration of white at the throat and chest. He had hunted up this fellow feline and made considerable efforts to communicate, but as far as he could tell, there was no higher intelligence flickering behind its blank green eyes. There was no intelligence at all, as far as Danby was concerned. He'd as soon try talking to a shrub. Finally, tiring of the eunuch's unblinking stare, he'd stalked off, foregoing more social experiments in favor of his mission. He sat for a long time under the forsythia hedge in Giles's front yard, studying the house for signs of life. He refused to be distracted by a cluster of sparrows cavorting on the birdbath, but he realized that unless a meal was coming soon, he would be reduced to foraging. The idea of hurling his bulk at a few ounces of twittering songbird made his scowl even more forbidding than usual. He licked a front paw and glowered at the silent house. After 20 minutes or so, he heard the distant hum of a car engine and smelled gasoline fumes. Danby peered out from the hedge in time to see Julie Eskridge's Mercedes rounding the corner from Windsor Way. With a few hasty licks to smooth down his ruff, Danby sauntered toward the driveway just as the car pulled in. Now for the hard part. How do you impress Julie Eskridge without a checkbook? He had never noticed before how much Giles's wife resembled a giraffe. He blinked at the sight of her huge feet swinging out of the car, perilously close to his nose. They were followed by two replicas of the Alaska pipeline, both encased in nylon. Better not jump on her. One claw on the stockings and he'd have an enemy for life. Julie was one of those people who air-kissed because she couldn't bear to spoil her makeup. Instead of trying to attract her attention at the car, where she could have skewered him with one spike heel, Danby loped to the steps of the side porch and began meowing piteously. As Julie approached the steps, he looked up at her with wide-eyed supplication, waiting to be admired.
"Shoo, cat,"
said Julie, nudging him aside with her foot. As the door slammed in his face, Danby realized that he had badly miscalculated. He had also neglected to devise a backup plan. A fine mess he was in now. It wasn't enough that he was murdered and reassigned to cathood. Now he was also homeless. He was still hanging around the steps 20 minutes later when Giles came home, mainly because he couldn't think of an alternate plan just yet. When he saw Giles's black sports car pull up behind Julie's Mercedes, Danby's first impulse was to run, but then he realized that, while Giles might see him, he certainly wouldn't recognize him as his old business partner. Besides, he was curious to see how an uncaught murderer looked. Would Giles be haggard with grief and remorse, furtive as he listened for police sirens in the distance? Giles Eskridge was whistling. He climbed out of his car, suntanned and smiling, with his lips pursed in a cheerfully tuneless whistle. Danby trotted forward to confront his murderer with his haughtiest scowl of indignation. The reaction was not quite what he expected. Giles saw the huge fluffy cat and immediately knelt down, calling, "Here, kitty, kitty." Danby looked at him as if he had been propositioned. "Aren't you a beauty?" said Giles, holding out his hand to the strange cat. "I'll bet you're a pedigreed animal, aren't you, fella? Are you lost, boy?" Much as it pained him to associate with a remorseless killer, Danby sidled over to his outstretched hand and allowed his ears to be scratched. He reasoned that Giles's interest in him was his one chance to gain entry to the house. It was obvious that Julie wasn't a cat fancier. Who would have taken heartless old Giles for an animal lover? Probably similarity of temperament, Danby decided. He allowed himself to be picked up and carried into the house, while Giles stroked his back and told him what a pretty fellow he was. This was an indignity, but still an improvement over Giles's behavior toward him during their last encounter. Once inside, Giles called out to Julie, "Look what I've got, honey."
She came in from the kitchen, scowling.
That nasty cat, she said. Put him right back outside.
At this point, Danby concentrated all his energies toward making himself purr. It was something like snoring, he decided, but it had the desired effect on his intended victim, for at once Giles made for his den and plumped down in an armchair, arranging Danby in his lap, with more petting and praise.
He's a wonderful cat, Julie, Giles told his wife. I'll bet he's a purebred Maine Coon. Probably worth a couple of $100.
So are my wool carpets, Mrs. Eskridge replied. So are my new sofas. And who's going to clean up his messes?
That was Danby's cue. He had already thought out the piece de resistance in his campaign of endearment. With a trill that meant, this way, folks, Danby hopped off his ex-partner's lap and trotted to the downstairs bathroom. He had used it often enough at dinner parties, and he knew that the door was left ajar. He had been saving up for this moment. With Giles and his missus watching from the doorway, Danby hopped up on the toilet seat, twitched his elegant plumed tail, and proceeded to use the toilet in the correct manner. He felt a strange tingling in his paws, and he longed to scratch at something and cover it up. But he ignored these urges, and basked instead in the effusive praise from his self-appointed champion. Why couldn't Giles have been that enthusiastic over his design for the Jenner building? Danby thought resentfully. Some people's sense of values was so warped. Meanwhile, though, he might as well savor the Eskridge's transports of joy over his bowel control. There weren't too many ways for cats to demonstrate superior intelligence. He couldn't quote a little Shakespeare or identify the dinner wine. Fortunately, among felines, toilet training passed for genius, and even Julie was impressed with his accomplishments.